This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
I am Glenda Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I am Christy Landwehr from Aurora, Colorado, and you are listening to a special training episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for June 17th, episode 936. This episode is brought to you by the Certified Horsemanship Association and Sterling Background Checks. Good morning, horse world!
Houston, we have a problem.
Ability equals skill plus knowledge.
Bad feeling about this.
Here's a safety tip for you from the Certified Horsemanship Association.
Missed it by that much.
How can I change this to make it better the next time?
Help you, I can. Yeah.
Time for Training Tuesday on Horses in the Morning with the Certified Horsemanship Association.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us this morning. We appreciate you listening to Horses in the Morning, and welcome everybody who's joining us for the first time from the Certified Horsemanship Association. Hi, Christy. Welcome back.
Hi, Glenn. How are you today?
Terrific. And, of course, Christy from the Certified Horsemanship Association joins us the third Tuesday of every month. If you've missed the past episodes of the CHA show, then you can just go back to horsesinthemorning.com. You'll find all of our past episodes there. Just do a search. For Certified Horsemanship Association in the search function, and it brings up all the past shows. You can take a listen. Plus, you have them over on your website, too, don't you?
We sure do. We have them under Marketing and Education. They're under there, under Horses in the Morning Radio Show.
And what's the website address?
CHA Instructors with an S at the end, .com.
CHAinstructors.com. Very good. Well, I was looking forward to talking to you again this month because we're in the heart of trail riding season and training season and showing season. I mean, everybody's just going nuts right now. They were all cooped up for the winter. It's now June. It's getting hot. And what's there better to do than go outside and play with your ponies?
Absolutely. I'll tell you, even I've been able to teach a couple lessons. I get to get off this computer every now and then and go and do stuff myself, Glenn. It's amazing.
I know, and there's no snow in the ground, so it's even better.
That helps. We just have tornadoes now and torrential flooding, but other than that, we're good.
Other than that,
good old Colorado.
Well, you don't have fires. I mean, when you have torrential flooding, you usually don't have fires, so that's good.
True.
Yeah.
Very true.
You guys do get a little bit of everything out there in Colorado, don't you?
We are never dull in the weather department.
No. And it's like they say about many other states. If you don't like the weather, it'll change in 5 minutes. Come back. It'll be
true.
Different. Yeah. And we're in thunderstorm season here in Florida. So every afternoon we have the wicked thunderstorms that build right over your head and sit there for an hour. So we get the daily rains now in the wet season, but you're kind of used to it when you live in Florida, and you know in an hour it's going to be gone and there'll be no mud. So that's one of the nice parts about it, is the no mud.
You have all those random lightning strikes out there. It can be sunny, you can be walking along the beach, and you can get hit by lightning. That is really random to me.
That is true. And, when we get our daily thunderstorms, they don't come through in waves, they don't come through in fronts, they build over your head. And the first thunderclap, that you always get one that starts it off, and it's totally out of the blue. And if it's right by you, I mean, you jump a foot because you haven't heard anything to that point, and it just scares the crap out of you.
Oh, there comes the first one.
And there comes the first one right now. So there we go. That's going to start our day off right here. Well, we have a good show planned for today. You have a bunch of guests lined up.
Yeah, I am really excited about today. We have Dale Rudin, and she resides in Tennessee, and we have Jill Montgomery, who resides here in Colorado with me, about 2 hours south of me in Pueblo West. And they have both been with CHA for a long time as instructors, and they have both been horse trainers and riding instructors for many years. So we're going to be talking about ground handling issues and how to solve them.
Oh, terrific. And I know we have a couple of tips we're going to lead off with here right now, actually. So the first one is taken off the CHA website, and it's about cross-tying. So let's take a listen to that.
Hi, my name is Michael Kays. I'm a CHA certified instructor, and this is Lucky, American Quarter Horse, and we're here to give you some safety tips about tying in the cross ties from CHA, the Certified Horsemanship Association. First of all, cross ties are a very common way to secure a horse in a barn or in a wash rack. And when you bring your horse into the cross ties, you secure them on one side, still keep the lead rope attached as you secure them on the other side. And you want to use a halter that is flat on the horse's head and that has hardware on the sides of the horse's face. This allows you the safest way to secure your horse, unlike a rope halter, which the ties can slide up and down on the rope. Where the horse is secured on the cross ties, it should be a quick release, as well as a quick release up at the top. This is because when your horse is in a situation where he's in an emergency, you can choose the safest place to release him from his cross ties. You want to keep in mind when working around a horse on cross ties, his vision. Just like when you're working around any other horse any other time, you have danger points or danger spots on the horse where a horse cannot see you, such as underneath of his neck, underneath of his belly, and directly behind him. So when you're working in cross ties, when you want to walk around the front of the horse, you want to go under the cross ties, around to the other side, so that the horse can see you the entire time you're moving from one side to the other. If you need to go around the back end of the horse, you want to move around the back end of the horse the same way you do when a horse is tied, staying close to the horse, keeping a hand on the horse, talking the entire time so the horse knows where you are. That way you can move him over and keep yourself in a safe position the entire time that you're moving. Quick releases can be in the way of a panic snap, which is commonly used on cross ties. Another way to do it is to have a daisy chain, quick release daisy chain, or a breakaway. Breakaways can be in the form of a shoestring or a piece of leather, thin leather, that will actually break in the event of an emergency. In order for the horse to have a comfortable tension on his cross ties, if I would snap the cross ties together, it would be just slightly lower than my horse's nose. And if you look at the comparison of where the hardware is on the sides of the halter to where the snaps occur, this amount of tension allows the horse freedom of his head and allows him to be very comfortable, yet confines him in such a way that he will not get himself into too much trouble by being able to stretch his head all the way around or to get his tack caught on his cross ties. It is always important when you have your horse in cross ties to never leave him unattended. By that I mean you should always have visual sight of the horse in the cross ties. That way if he gets himself in trouble, you can come to his rescue. If there's a time a horse needs to be brought through the aisleway when you have your horse in cross ties, the safe way to do that is to unclip your horse with a lead rope attached to your horse, unclip one cross tie, hang on to your horse, scoot him over a little bit, easy, and make way for the other horse coming through. And they lead up the horse alongside of your horse. And then reattach them. Again, do that with a lead rope, not just hanging onto his halter.
Well, I know that we're gonna follow up on that tip about cross tying a little bit later with one of our guests. So let's just go right into bridling. And this is brought to you by our good friend, Julie Goodnight.
Here's a safety tip for you from the Certified Horsemanship Association about bridling your horse. First, always make sure your horse is untied before you begin bridling. Or if you have your horse in the cross ties, make sure you've released one of the ties. We don't want to startle the horse and have her throw her head up and end up pulling back on the rope. But before I bridle, I'll just slip the halter off and fasten it around her neck so that I can still maintain control of the horse. I would never leave my horse tied like this or leave her unattended because it's not a safe situation. But while I'm in the act of bridling, the halter around the neck will help me keep control of my horse. I'll place my right hand over the pole
grab the crown piece with my right hand, and now my left hand is free to guide the bit into the horse's mouth. Pulling the curb strap back and placing all four fingers on the mouthpiece of the bit, I'll gently bring the bit up to the horse's mouth, wait for her to open her mouth, and pull up on the head stall in order to get the bit high in her mouth and protect it from hitting her teeth. Gently, I'll start with the offside ear, fold the ear forward, bring the head stall over, and then the near side ear. And I want to square up the brow band, fasten the throat latch. The throat latch is what holds your bridle in place and keeps it from coming off accidentally. And I want to make sure that I have three fingers stacked one on top of each other underneath the throat latch in order to make sure the bridle is held in place without causing discomfort to my horse. And then I'll move down to check the bit, make sure it's level in the horse's mouth. And finally, I want to check the adjustment on the chin strap. I want to be able to have two fingers stacked one on top of each other under the horse's jaw and make sure that when the shank reaches a 45 degree angle that the curb strap is engaged. Now that I've got my horse bridled and saddled, all I need is a helmet and I'll be ready to ride.
Well, it's always fun to hear from Julie, and we're going to be talking about bridling a little bit later on in the show. I have some stories with my pony on both cross-tying and bridling, so I can't wait to chat about those a little bit later on in the show. And you, you know, my pony, I can't cross-tie him because he just wants to roll. We have sand in our aisles. We're in Florida. We have sand everywhere, right? And when I cross-tie him, he wants to roll, so he hangs himself. It was the most bizarre thing the first time he went down to roll while being cross-eyed, and his neck is all sideways, and I'm furiously trying to get him unhooked so he doesn't choke to death. It was disaster, so we don't cross-tie him anymore.
Yeah. The weirdest part of that whole experience for me was the fact that he was not in the least bit concerned.
No, he didn't care.
He didn't care.
I thought it was normal.
It's like, yeah, so I'm hanging by my nose. So what? I'm going to roll in the dirt whether it happens or not. Completely.
So I have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you have those quick release snaps on both sides of your cross tie?
Yeah, but he's not heavy enough to break them to make them work.
But you could undo it on the wall, right, and then have a lead rope instead of having to unattach it right where he is.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah, but
good.
I don't even take a chance anymore because we thought it was a fluke. We thought, well, he was just itchy that day, you know? So, you know, there was another time I went to cross time. We were going to harness him up to go driving. And I just turned around to get the harness inside the tack room, which is right there, three steps away. I come out of the tack room and he's on the ground doing it again. And it's like, okay, well.
That's not going to work.
We can't do that anymore. But he doesn't do it if you just tie him. Yeah, but you have to tie him pretty short. Yeah, most
bizarre thing.
He just likes
to be hard tied better.
I guess
he just wants you to practice that quick release knot, Glenn.
I guess he just. But I've never seen a horse do that. Have you seen horses just want to roll while they're in a cross ties like that?
Well, I don't have fabulous sand footing where I live on rocks and clay, so.
Oh, yeah, you don't have to worry about that. Sorry about that. Didn't mean to rub it in.
You put some stall mats down, maybe. Maybe it's just because it's just so sandy and lovely. He's like, oh, I just want to do this. Whereas if there's stall mats, maybe he won't do it.
And, you know, we do have stall mats where we tie him now, you know, where we just single tie him. And he hates the stall mats. He walks off of them. He does everything he can to get away from the stall. He's the most bizarre little hackney pony.
Well, but, no, Glenn.
Yes.
You don't have to say with the word bizarre. Hackney pony really does say
it all.
Yeah,
that kind of says it all. It's sort of. Yeah.
They're unique.
Now, so tell us real quick before we get to our first guest about a horse handling lesson that you learned the hard way, sort of like we're learning with our pony.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, you know, you like to incriminate yourself on this radio show. It's just really, really fun to be able to do that. I think that's fabulous. But no, my big thing is horses that pull back. And I'll tell you, when they pull back, you know, you've got to not do anything. And your first reaction when they pull back, especially when they're hard tied, is you want to go to that quick release knot and quick release them, right, and get them out of that situation. It's actually not a good idea, though, because you could, you know, remove digits from your hand and other problems when you're trying to do that or get in the way of the horse. You need to just stand there, let them get through it, and then be done with it. But my story comes from my quarter horse mare, Jesse. I had her out tied to our little tie rail, and it's galvanized pipe, and it's concreted into the ground. And we have little, my husband is galvanized onto there because he's Mr. Welder guy, a little piece of metal that it can kind of go around so that the lead rope fits through so she can't slide up and down the pipe. So I had her on that. Everything was going fine. Thank goodness it wasn't a student situation. It was just me going to go for a ride, and I'm grooming her. And all of a sudden, out of the galvanized pipe, because we had not put end caps on them,
uh-oh,
here come the hornets.
Uh-oh.
Here they come. Big old swarm of them. So my mare and I are getting covered and stung. I've never been stung by a hornet. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I don't know if she's ever been stung by a hornet. All I know is, thank goodness I knew how to do a quick release knot, and I pulled it before she pulled back. Because had she pulled back and tightened that thing, I couldn't have gotten her undone. So I did the quick release knot, and I ran one way. She ran the other. She ran over to the nearest patch of grass, and they stopped stinging her, and she just started eating. I ran into the house thinking, I wonder if I'm going to need an EpiPen. I don't even know if I'm allergic or not. I ended up being fine. I just had a big, fat red arm for a day or two, and put some white vinegar on it, and it actually went away. And the mare was fine. She'd had a couple of bumps on her, and they also went away within a day or two. And boy, the very next day, my husband was out there putting end caps on.
I bet he was. Wow.
Now, you did a smart thing, too, in that you just let the horse go, and you took off the other direction. If you'd tried to take off with the horse, you know, more disaster could have happened. You know, that's a tough one, though, when you're in the heat of the moment, what you're going to do. You know, I would have been, my inclination would have been to, you know, take the horse with me. Yeah, but then what do you do when you get to the house?
Well, I knew she was just going to hang out, you know, with the other horse. I mean, I only have two horses, so she was just going to go back to her buddy and eat grass, and I knew that, so I was out of there. I was like, sorry, Mary, you're on your own, man. All men for themselves. We're on our own.
That's right. That's funny.
But she did great. I was very proud of her, and I was very proud of my husband knowing how to do end caps, so that's all done, and I'm very proud that it was me and not a student that that happened to. So it all worked out how it was supposed to, but boy.
Yeah, we've all had the run-in with the bee nest, you know, that catches you off guard. Sometimes when you're out trail riding or, you know, anywhere.
The bee's nest in the horse trailer. That's my favorite.
Oh, yeah, that's always a good one.
Oh, yeah. Scary.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's head off to our first guest. Why don't you introduce our first guest is Rizzo.
Well, Rizzo is actually with Background Checks, and it's Sterling Background Checks. And I actually met Rizzo because quite a few of our riding instructors run camp programs. And a lot of them are actually camps themselves, like YMCAs, Boy Scouts, things like that. About 40% of our membership actually is in camping. And they wanted to be able to have a good environment to do background checks on any camp staff that they might be hiring to work with kids. So Rizzo and I got in contact, and away we went. So it's a pleasure to have him on the show today to tell us a little bit more about what they do there at Sterling. Hi, Rizzo. I am so glad to have you on the show today. I just did an introduction of you and talked a little bit about Sterling background checks and how about 40% of our members are in camping, and the camping industry is very into having their staff have background checks. And so we're thrilled to have you work with CHA and to help our folks find good staff. So could you tell us a little bit more about Sterling and about what you do over there?
For sure, Christine. Thanks so much for having me on the show, first of all. It's been a pleasure working with you over the last few months. I mean, in terms of Sterling, we are currently one of the largest background screening companies in the entire country. Been doing it for about 40 years now, work with well over 20,000 companies. Some include Walt Disney, ESPN, Walmart, Vitamin Shoppe, and really it runs across all verticals. In terms of several differentiators that we've had here, and there's a ton, innovation, compliance, and client services are really the cornerstones of this business. I mean, we're big believers that a background check is not just a background check, and nor should it ever be. I mean, with us, it's all about innovation. Nobody out there innovates anymore, and so many vendors are stuck in the past. So we're really ongoing, spending millions to weed out bad apples, protect your brand. And the bottom line is, I mean, the background screening industry, there's no perfect science right now. You know, and anybody telling any company out there that they can eliminate their risk completely is lying. Any company ever says that to you, you run away or you hang up. It's really impossible. So we're really here to mitigate your risk. There's no such thing as a bulletproof background check right now, but we're developing this company in a way that allows us to really channel technology, highly competent employees, and financial stability to provide programs that are about as thorough and fine-tuned as possible at this particular moment in time. So, I mean, you mentioned, you know, the camp industry, and again, the, you know, there's a ton of children at the camps. Employees need to be background screened. It's just an important component.
Is that required in most places?
It depends. Right. It depends on state laws. It depends on regulations. They are variances from state to state. There are some states that do require them and other states not so much.
Okay.
Now, even in the places where they're required, some companies will sort of utilize low-priced background screening, which unfortunately, in this industry especially, you really do get what you pay for. So, I mean, that's a great transition actually at this point. I mean, in terms of innovation, I talked about that a little bit. And anyone who has done their share of background screening has no doubt heard the term court runner. And basically, a court runner is an individual hired by a company to go to a courthouse, computer terminal, manually input information on a consent form, bring data back to the company for the reports that are provided to clients. Now, of the 20 million searches or so that we do on an annual basis, we use court runners in less than 30% of the time. And I mean, this is very significant for a few reasons. I mean, from the process I just described, I mean, you can see how much room there is for human error there. What if a court runner, for example, was kept up all night by his kids, and while entering a social security number at the courthouse, he flips a 6 and a 9? All of a sudden, he's just cleared a rapist, and he gets onboarded with the company or a camp. So, I mean, what did we do to circumvent the use of court runners? It's technology again, really. I mean, about 12 years ago, Sterling began to invest money to integrate our computer systems with courthouse computer systems and essentially build digital pipelines to draw information from primary sources. So anything reported to a courthouse, we get it in real time. And to date, over $50 million have been invested in the system, and it's led to a huge improvement in accuracy and turnaround time. So not only are we covering 70% of the country through this method, but as a result, we've eliminated human error, we guarantee more accurate results, and shorter time. On average, we're looking at about a 15-hour turnaround time for a very thorough search going straight to the primary sources. And in terms of some of the camps I have reached out to in the past few months, you know, there's been a few. I noticed that a lot of them that I encountered were using national databases as their primary sources of information. Now this, I mean, that's sort of what I was talking about before, where some companies will do the bare minimum just to say that they've been background screening. And there's tons of holes in the national search. It's cheap, it's convenient, it's fast, which is why a lot of people do go to it. But unless you're actually validating the information that turns up there, it's illegal to make a hiring decision based on it.
Mm-hmm. Just some practical questions here. And
sure.
Christy, help out here. Are camps the only one, Christy, of like your CHA members that are even doing background checks at this point, or some of the larger barns? Or
you know, some of the most of the reason why I mentioned camps is that they're that some of them require them.
Right.
Like Boy Scouts of America, for example, it's
right.
a requirement. So due to that fact, you know, that's why I mentioned those. Now, some of our larger barns and things might start to go down that road. I haven't heard of a whole lot of them doing so as of yet. However, you know, I think that it's just around the corner for some of them.
And is it cost that is the reason that a lot of them, you know, haven't gone this route, or even some of the camps are, you know, is it expensive or, you know?
Sure. That does have a lot to do with it. Especially if you're dealing with a nonprofit, for example, whose budget's limited, background screening might be a luxury more than something they can actually implement. We work with a ton of nonprofits. We have an actual arm of the company known as Verified Volunteers, who I believe just actually began working with the Girl Scouts, so there's a little symmetry between what you just talked about. But they will provide background screening programs for volunteers, and that is more affordable. There's highly reduced fees. It's becoming really popular. It's really the only thing of its kind. It gives the candidate an option of not only donating to the actual organization that they're being screened for, but paying for part of the background check themselves. So that has really gone a long way in helping nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. Is this only criminal background check? Is it criminal? Is that the only thing you're looking at in this case?
In that case, there's also drug screening. We do drug screening as well.
Okay.
And credit checks are an option for financial hires. Let's say, you know, you have a controller or a CFO that has a lot of access to financials. We can do credit checks on them. Federal checks are also different than a national search would be on a national database. But really, I mean, we are a sole source solution. So any form of background screening you can think of, we provide it.
And so if somebody wanted to do this and they decided that they wanted to use your company to use Sterling Background Check, what do they do?
Sure. They can reach out to me. I think Christy has my contact information somewhere or another. And it's really pretty simple. I mean, in terms of getting an account up and running, once we have the paperwork back, 24 to 48 hours, and you're good to go. You can put in your first background check. We have training every day at 1 p.m. for clients. Whether you're a new client or an existing client, you can always go for a refresher. I would be primary point of contact, and first few checks I will walk everybody through. All my clients have been walked through their first initial checks by me. And we just try to make compliance, the actual search, as streamlined as possible. And training is so important, just because it's an ever-fluid environment in background screening. I mean, compliance is really one of the directions in which this is going. I mean, it's becoming just as important as quality technology. And I think that's another area, actually, that might turn smaller companies, nonprofits, and lower volume organizations away from background screening is the fact that they fear the compliance requirements on it. Compliance, again, is a huge part. People are afraid of being sued. I mean, we live in the paranoia of the NSA age. So people are always concerned about their personal information and what they're doing with it, where they're getting it, how it's being used by companies. But I mean, there are hundreds of companies.
But Glenn, I guess that's what I really liked about Rizzo was the fact that Sterling, you can pay one price and then there's a bunch of add-ons. So there's not just one fee. You can choose to do something in kind of more shallow waters or you can choose to do it in deeper waters. And Rizzo, we're going to have to wrap up. But if you want to go ahead and give us the website address where people can go and let them know a little bit more, go ahead and give that to everyone, please.
Yeah, for sure. The website is www.sterlingbackcheck.com. You can also directly reach out to me. I think Christy has my number on the CHA website, but just to kind of reiterate that, my direct office line here is 646-485-3759, and I'm glued to my desk from 9 a.m. to 5 Eastern Standard Time. So anybody that wants to reach out, even for a consultative call, it doesn't necessarily have to lead to a sale. If you have any questions about background screening in general, I'm more than happy to help out.
Thank you, Rizzo.
Great. So our first guest today is going to be Dale, who's actually going to talk about our topic for the day, which is ground handling issues and how to solve them. And Dale Rudin, I met her actually at a CHA International conference that we did a few years back in Lexington, Kentucky, and she came down and did a wonderful talk. She had riders up, and she was doing a great talk demonstrating different types of Western horsemanship style of riding at the time. But Dale is certified in both English and Western with us, and she does a lot on horse behavior and horse behavior issues in Middle Tennessee. And Dale, it's just a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for asking me.
Well, what we did, we came up with a group of kind of ground handling issues that between Glenn and his wife Jennifer and myself and others that we've kind of had over the years that I think a lot of people, whether you're a beginner, an intermediate, or advanced person in horses, you encounter these things. They just happen. So I would love to just get started right away on our first topic, which is catching horses. It's the necessary thing of life. You've got to go put a halter on them. And for some of us, it's really easy. They're in a 12 by 12 box stall, right? Not a whole lot of places to go. But some of us have to go catch our horse out in a really large pasture with other horses. So I think let's delve into the hardest of all, which is catching a horse out in a pasture, in a field with all their buddies, and you're having to take them away from their buddies. What are some techniques and strategies, Dale, that you recommend, and maybe some problems and things that you've encountered and how you've overcome them?
Yeah, this is such, I think, a huge topic and a problem that people have. And, to some degree, they don't even realize that it's a problem. They think their horse is hard to catch, and it's just the horse. You know, the horse, for some reason, isn't friendly, or, they kind of categorize it as an idiosyncrasy of the horse. And really what's going on is the horse is feeling insecure or upset for some reason about being caught. In fact, I'll share a quick story. I have a friend who said that she had a horse that was hard to catch until she realized that every time she caught it, it was on the weekend, and she would only take it out for a 20-mile trail ride. So pretty quickly, the horse figured out there's no reason for me to want to be caught because what's coming is going to be really strenuous. So, really paying attention to why a horse isn't being caught is as important as getting the horse caught, because if it's a stressful outcome for the horse, then every time you go to catch him, it's going to be difficult. So for some horses, they have insecurity. They're just not comfortable, having a human walk up to them for some reason. They may be herd bound and actually want to just stick so close to the other horses that they're difficult to catch. So whatever the reason is, when you go to catch a horse that is being resistant, our tendency, and one of the things that I see a lot when I'm working with people, is the horse walks away and the person stops because the person is thinking, I've done something to startle or upset the horse, and so I'm going to back off. And actually, what you want to do is the opposite. You want to track the horse. You want to follow the horse, keep yourself part of what the horse is doing so that the horse realizes that there's some interaction going on, even if at that point he doesn't want to participate. As time goes by and you're following this horse around, and by the way, let me say that, if you have a horse that's difficult to catch, you need to take the time and, you know, block whatever amount of time it's going to take. It could be an hour, it could be a couple of hours, to get that horse used to you being present and understand that you're not going to go away just because he walks away from you. So when you approach that horse and he walks away, you need to follow him. And for the horse, he's not going to quite understand what's going on, but if you continue to follow and you're not chasing, there's no energy behind it, you're just following the horse so that he can't get rid of you, but you're not putting any additional pressure on him. As that horse continues to move away from you, at some point he's going to think, okay, well, what's going on here? And he's either going to stop or he's going to turn and look at you. The moment that either of those things happen, you want to take the pressure off of him. So you want to turn away and take a step away. Because now that horse has acknowledged that you're there and he's giving you his attention. Once he's done that and you've turned away, you're giving him a reward. There's a reason for him to turn toward you instead of walk away from you, and you go away a little bit when that happens. Once he does that, you can try approaching again. He might walk away again. He may not. But the important thing here is that when you're approaching, that you're not walking directly into his space, but you're going to come at an angle so that your trajectory is going to take you out beyond his head, or you're going to stay parallel to the horse. And over time, even if he walks away from you, he's going to do that stop and turn again, and you're going to turn away, and he's going to start to understand the pattern that when he turns towards you, you turn away, and that will start to get more frequent. Eventually, you'll be able to get close enough where the horse is going to stand still. Now, you may not be able to reach out and touch him, and actually what I always recommend my clients do is they position themselves out in front of the horse a couple of feet, still turned away from them, specifically so that their chest is turned away so that you're not facing the horse down. You can look at the horse over your shoulder, but not square, you know, again, with your chest pointed toward them. And then I tell them to reach out with their hand toward the horse so their hand is maybe a couple of inches or a few inches away from the horse's face. They may be several feet away from the horse if the horse isn't allowing them to get that close. And they hold their hand out and invite the horse to come over and make contact with the back of their hand. And the hand is palm down with the fingers softly curled. Once the horse makes contact or, you know, steps towards you, the instinct is, well, now I'm going to try to catch the horse, but you really actually want to move away at that point. So again, the horse is learning that the pressure is gone every time they approach and they make an effort to connect with you. Now, you mentioned, Christy, that there could be other horses in the pasture. You have to be aware of where those other horses are. A lot of horses that are difficult to catch will hide behind another horse, and so you're maneuvering a little bit. You can't see me.
No, wait a minute. Can I add that they're always hiding behind another horse? Not just sometimes. Or a tree.
Absolutely.
We've had that happen. The biggest tree in the field will be the one that he's dancing around behind. And why does the horse that you're trying to catch never have a halter on? Ever?
Of course not.
Never. No.
And you have an appointment, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you need to go someplace now. Yeah.
Yes,
exactly.
or the vet's on his way, or the farrier, or the standing rider truck.
Or you're in Florida and it's pouring down rain. Yeah, that's the other one.
Well, you're quite the diehard if you're in Florida in that situation. It's this process of putting some pressure on the horse, and then every time the horse tries to come toward you, taking that pressure off. So even if there's another horse around that he's hiding behind, you just continue to follow. I have spent many an afternoon walking around the horse that doesn't know what's going on. He just stands there and keeps eating while we're walking circles around him. So, yeah, you want to be aware of what that the non-volunteer horse, the horse that's kind of in the way, what he's doing is he's getting upset by things. But the horse that you're trying to catch, you just have to be persistent and not give up.
I still appreciate these things because I'll tell you, you're absolutely right about the 20-mile ride. You know, we call them the weekend warriors, right? And they don't have time to ever work their horse unless it's on the weekend. And then they go and they ride the horse for 20 miles. Think about how body sore that horse is going to be for the next 4 or 5 days. How body sore are we when we only work out once a week, right? And so to take your horse occasionally and go let it have some grass in hand, and then to put the horse back in the field. And they go, really? I didn't get saddled, brushed, ridden, nothing. I just got to eat some grass in hand, or I got some special, maybe a carrot or two or whatever, and then got put back in the field. I mean, I think that was such valuable information right at the start, all the way up to how to do this in a very simple, concise way. And you are so good. I was just thinking of explaining things visually but auditorily, right? Because on the radio, I was visualizing exactly what you were talking about while you were saying it. So good job.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. It's interesting that the woman I was talking about who had the horse that she was riding hard and when the horse wouldn't let her catch it, she started catching the horse and grooming it and putting it back, and then that problem was solved. So, yeah, that's the way it works. I mean, they are thinking, they're connecting dots, you know. We kind of like to think that they're not, but they are. So, and we get
they
caught
sure
on
are.
That.
So once we have them caught, and now we're going to figure out tying. I know that different barns and different equine facilities have different types of tying methods. Some use cloth ties, some use hard tying. What are some suggestions that you have for folks in regards to tying, and what are some safety things that you have in regards to both cloth ties and hard tying?
Well, tying is one of those things that you know, everybody at some point is going to have some kind of an issue with, because horses are prey animals, and if they feel trapped, you know, and they're confined, then they're going to panic. That's their tendency, is to panic. So you know, number one is making sure that whatever they're tied to is something that is secure, that isn't going to pull out when, you know, a 1,000-pound or more animal is fighting against the end of a line. We either want them to stay attached to it. We don't want anything coming at them, you know, a stall door, a gate, anything like that. That's just a train wreck that nobody wants to have to go through. Secondly, the ground. I think that's something that, you know, people tend to forget is what the horse is standing on. If the ground is slippery, even a horse that doesn't have any issue with tying could just slip, you know. It could be even on a mat. Some mats, if they get wet, you know, a horse urinates. I mean, then they're on a very, very slippery footing, and he could just shift a little bit, slip, lose his footing, and go down. So, you know, I always like to plan ahead for, you know, the worst-case scenario and hope it never comes, but having a horse tied on, you know, something that he can get his feet on. He has some traction, some small gravel, sand, grass. Grass can be a little bit slippery sometimes too, but, you know, making sure that he's on something that feels solid and secure to him. And then if he does go down, that he's not going to have severe impact injuries, as, you know, he would if he was tied on concrete or, rock or something like that. As far as hard tying versus cross tying, yeah, you can kind of come across any version of tying. Number one, the higher the horse is tied, the less leverage he has to pull. So you always want to tie above the withers or higher. If the horse is cross tied, it's a good idea, and straight tied, for there to be some way to release the horse quickly. or for him to release himself. So if he's tied, hard tied, you know, having the rope or whatever it is he's tied to be a piece of baling twine, something that if there's enough force on it, it'll snap, and you can do the same thing with a cross tie. And if for some reason it doesn't snap quickly, always have a knife or a pair of scissors. You can so quickly cut through that, and you can get that horse free if you need to. Cross tying is, you know, I see people cross tying in barn aisles and different situations like that. You know, if at all possible, a horse that's cross tied is going to be safer if he has sides and a back, so that he can't just go forever to the, you know, and pull against the ties without coming to some kind of an end. If he, you know, kind of runs backwards and there's a wall there, then he's done going backwards, and then he's not going to feel as confined and trapped when he feels that pressure pulling against his head. Same with the sides. If he starts to go sideways, it will be difficult for him to get himself turned around and twisted, because a horse can do that. You know, they'll flip directions. An interesting thing to see, you have a horse standing there, you run into the tack room to grab something and come back, and he's facing the other direction and looking confused. So, you know, making sure that that horse is actually trained to tie well and is comfortable with that in the first place is a great place to start. And what I do before I cross tie or straight tie a horse is teach the horse to stand still while I'm grooming him or tacking him up, just with me holding onto the lead rope, so that he is already comfortable with being handled and touched, and he's not fighting that, and then also having more stress from, you know, feeling the confinement of his head being attached to something at the same time.
Very good idea. And I'll tell you what's so interesting. Right before you got on, Dale, Glenn was talking about his Hackney pony. And he puts his Hackney pony in cross ties, but they're in Florida. They have nice sandy soil. So every now and then the pony goes, oh, I'm going to roll. So he'll go down, and that he's not heavy enough to actually get the quick release to snap undone if it's attached to his halter. So they have a quick release also on the end that's attached to the wall, so they can go ahead and have a lead rope and get him free and get him unattached. But having those hay strings go in between where the quick release snap is and his halter, you know, even a Hackney pony would be heavy enough to break a hay string. So I love that idea. I think that's great.
You know what, though? The non-plasticky ones are getting harder to find. And a lot of hay bales are now done in those plasticky ones, which are harder to break. So you have to be aware of that, too. You know, the days of plain old baler twine are going away, I think.
we're gonna have to come up with an alternative.
Yeah.
I thought about using like really small zip ties, and I haven't tested that theory yet to see what it would take to break that.
Well, you need a horse over 300 pounds. See, that's the problem. Oh. That's the problem I've got.
It's because you drive and don't ride, Glenn. See,
that's
you
right.
know how it is.
That's right. That's right. And he's also one that, you know, when I first got him, you know, he was a starving case. He was a rescue. So, he came with some issues. But when I first got him, you know, I wouldn't say he's the most difficult to bridle horse. I know that's something we're going to get to later in the show. But he also had a little bit of trouble with that. But I think all horses have that in the beginning, too. I love what you said about catching the horses in the field, simply because we've all been there. We've all had that horse that for what, you know, and it might be that horse that did it every time, or it was the horse that just decided he wasn't going to play that day. So, we've all been down that road, and I love your description of doing it, and I don't think that I was doing it quite right either, so I'm waiting for one to play that game so I can try it.
Well, I hope you don't have to try it, but please let me know how it turns out should you have the opportunity.
Very good. Well, we're running out of time here, Christy. Dale, do you have a website or anything?
I sure do. It's you can look it up through my name, DaleRudin.com. And also, it's also under unnaturalhorsemanship.com, and it's UN-naturalhorsemanship. And that's what I call what I do. And so that's what I'm going to say about it. But you can find me under either of those.
Thanks, Dale. Bye-bye.
Welcome. Bye-bye. Thanks so much.
Well, that's true. You know, that field thing is something that we've had some of the especially bad ones. And, you know, you do get those ones that do it occasionally, and you can tolerate them. It's the ones that are just every single time that are the ones that try your patience. And it is hard. It is hard to do everything she said because your patience is being tried at the same time.
Absolutely. And I also want to kind of lead people down a path. You know, go to our YouTube site. I know we did a couple of the audio tracks this morning on some of the other topics like cross tying and bridling, but we have a great one on hard tying. We have another really good one on catching a horse in a herd. And so you can visually see some of what Dale's talking about. And also you can put the rope over the neck of the horse and then go alongside the horse and put the halter on. I know a lot of, especially people that are kind of new to horses, will go at them directly towards their face with the halter. And the horse doesn't like that. The horse doesn't see really well, right, directly in front of them. They see much better on the side because that's where their eyes are located. So to put a rope around their neck first, then go ahead and put the end of the halter, you know, around their neck by their ears, and then go over and actually put it on their nose and buckle it might be an easier way, too, for folks that are having issues.
Yeah. Both of our horses are put the rope around my neck first, please.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Both of them are.
Yep. Which is good practice anyway. Well, let's take a break for our song today, and then we have more show coming back talking about other ground issues that we all have to deal with on a daily basis. So we'll be right back after this.
Friday night and the phone won't ring. You let it get you so blue. Climbing the walls of your pink bedroom. Feels like the world's leaving you behind. But girl, I got good news. There's a storybook ending. It's waiting for you. Just had a crystal ball. If you could see what I do, you know it ain't nothing we ain't all been through. I cried those tears once upon a time. Yeah, I wore no shoes. Let our sister just listen. Your wish is gonna come true.
Soon.
Well, that was Patty Hall with Settle Down Cinderella. You're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network. I am Glenn the Geek here with Christy from the Certified Horsemanship Association with our once-a-month training episode. Coach Jen is in the producer chair as well. Next up, we have our next guest for you, brought to you by the Certified Horsemanship Association, Jill Montgomery, to talk a little bit about more ground issues that we have to deal with horses.
Jill, it's so great to have you on today. We just had Dale discussing some ground handling issues, such as how to catch horses safely in a herd, cross tying and hard tying, and we had done a couple of our YouTube videos actually earlier in the show, too, on cross tying and the one on bridling, too. But then I know we're going to get to those topics here in just a second. But if you could do us a favor, and let's just start out. Now that we've caught our horse, we've led our horse, we've tied our horse, now we're going to go ahead and start grooming our horse. So how about for those horses out there that have issues with picking up their hooves to have their hooves cleaned? What are some solution steps you have, whether it's a front hoof or a back hoof?
Well, I'd kind of like to start and make sure that the person who's trying to clean that horse's feet has the idea that it's not them that's picking up the foot, it's rather the horse that's going to pick up the foot. And it's not exactly a natural behavior for them as prey animals to pick up a foot and turn it over. So they have to be taught to pick up their feet and allow you to hold them and work on them. So I guess the first thing, if the horse has not already been trained and you're not just trying to deal with an issue fear or bad experiences with having their feet worked on, would be to start with a calm environment and stand with you're facing the horse's rear, and when you take your hand down the back of their leg and ask them to lift their foot, you then slide in with your other hand to cradle the foot. But if the horse doesn't respond with just an ask, to kind of move to the next level of request, a tell, if you will, you can, again, slide your hand down the horse's leg, and behind the knee is a chestnut, which is a hairless, like a callus type of piece on the horse's leg, and put a little gentle pressure on that. And most horses will just pick their foot up when that's pressed. If it doesn't pick it up at that point, just try and slowly increase that pressure until the horse picks up its foot. As soon as he picks up his foot, release the pressure, slide your hand the rest of the way down the foot, and cradle that foot. Horses would rather have their foot held, the hoof held, in a cradle than both hands, so that they still have some sense that they have the ability to get their hoof if they were in trouble and needed to go somewhere. So they're generally more relaxed if you just cradle it. At that point, you could start tapping on the horse's foot if it hasn't already been trained to have its hooves picked. The sole of the foot needs to be cleaned out, as well as the grooves next to the frog. And when you are finished cleaning the horse's foot, you want to make sure that you're aware of where your feet are when you release the foot and allow the horse to put it back down on the ground. I think most people who have worked with horses for very long have at least once had their foot stepped on, and it's very unpleasant. So keeping an eye out for where the horse is likely to put its foot down and making sure your foot isn't there is a good safety tip.
Yes, and Jill, I have just a little story to interject there. I had a student once that, and this is years ago now, and she went ahead and put the horse's foot down right on top of her foot, and then immediately started to pull her foot out instead of pushing the horse off of her. So needless to say, bye-bye big toenail. So definitely, even with boots on, that can happen. So once, you know, that does happen, pushing the horse off versus trying to panic and pull your foot out from under might be a great thing too.
And when it comes to horses that are resistant to having their to picking up their foot for you, I think you really need to focus on that as a task that they should practice every day. And It doesn't hurt to clean your horse's feet when you feed them in the morning or in the evening if you have them in stalls. It's actually very effective at improving that behavior, and it only takes a couple of minutes to do it. So a frequency of handling their feet, I think, is a good idea for horses that have been sticky about it. If the only time they have their feet picked up is when the farrier comes, that's not fair for your horse or the farrier, and it's also a good thing for the veterinarian for them to be compliant about lifting their feet for you.
Do you think that there's anything that the listeners need to pay attention to in regards to the hind legs versus the front?
Yes. You're not going to have a chestnut to squeeze on the back leg. The area that you could apply pressure to there would be on the calf of the hock, it'll get you the same type of result as the chestnut does. But I always try and just ask first by sliding my hand all the way down the leg and seeing if they lift their foot, and then your timing being ready to cradle that foot when it does come up is important. So on the back foot, even more so. The horses that are really resistant to having their feet worked on might kick or snap it on a back leg, and it's critical that the person picking up that foot be to the side and looking back at the horse's tail, if you will, when they're trying to pick up that foot so that you can get out of the way if they were to grab their foot away and kick out.
Absolutely. So thank you for those comments on hoof picking. I think those are all absolutely wonderful. And now let's say horse is groomed, we're ready to go, but now, unfortunately, I've got a horse that's a little what we tend to term as cinchy or girthy. What are some solution steps there for folks?
Well, I think the first thing is always, when you have a problem like that, to assess the horse's situation and if this a new problem or is this an old problem. If it's a new problem, then you definitely want to look at the animal for sores or swelling, tender spots under the cinch area, or on its back. Have you changed tack? You want to rule out the injury of the animal or poor fit of your saddle. And if that is the problem, you need to seek advice from your vet or your trainer and try and rectify those problems without really blaming the horse. But if it's more of a behavioral issue, first thing you're going to do is make sure that your tack fits and is clean, and that the area on the horse's skin where it's going to come in contact with that equipment is also clean, so you're not creating an irritation on the horse's skin. But if they just resent having the saddle tightened, then you really have a process to work through. And I would start by pulling that cinch just tight enough so that the saddle isn't going to slide off when he walks. And I would really take my time with that. I would take him from where you're saddling and try and find another place where he could be safely tied for a few minutes. And at that second place, snug up the girth just a little, and then repeat that. And you might take, 15 or 20 minutes to teach this horse that he doesn't have to panic when the cinch is being tightened. Most horses get cinchy because they've been tightened too quickly or too tightly. So doing this progression of slowly tightening the girth in different areas helps him relax, and that's what you want. You want to be slow and deliberate when you tighten that cinch. And by the time you get to where you're going to have to mount, that's where you'll have to have it tight enough to get on. And for me, I like to have it tight enough so that I can still put a finger underneath the center of the the girth underneath the horse's chest. Another common place to measure is right behind their elbow, where it'd be two fingers underneath the girth behind their elbow. And those two spots generally correlate pretty well if the horse is not holding its breath. But if you take several opportunities on the way to where you're going to get on to tighten that cinch, you're probably going to have a better result in teaching that horse that he can relax even when that cinch is tightened.
Jill, I really appreciate you mentioning to check it across the horse's sternum at the bottom of their belly, you know, and not necessarily always where the horse is concave. We always go and try to check right where we attach it, and the horse is always going to be concave there. And so even us ladies can over-tighten horses to the point where they're way too tight, and it's actually going to hurt them and make them more cinchy or girthy in the future. So thank you so much for bringing that up.
One other thing that I think is worth mentioning is when you're in the process of tightening that cinch, you don't want to take the end of the latigo and put it into the keeper, because it's so easy to forget that you're not all the way tight. So letting that dangle until you've really got it to the point where you need it to step into the saddle is a good idea.
That's a really good point. And the same thing could be said for the English billet straps. You can go ahead and leave those undone and not tuck them into your girth if you have one that kind of goes in like that, same exact thing. And then you know, I'm not quite ready yet.
Yes.
Great idea. So now how about the difficult horse to bridle? I know we've all been there. I'm really, really lucky. I'm almost 6 foot tall. So if I have a hard horse to bridle, I just stand on my tiptoes and I can get most of them accomplished. But, you know, when we're teaching our students, or if we're quite a bit shorter or we're working with kids, boy, can that be a challenge when that horse has been clunked in the teeth, either on putting the bit in or taking the bit off, or maybe they have ear issues. What are some of your steps for folks out there that are having some issues bridling their horse?
Well, again, first I want to figure out if the horse has a legitimate injury or problem with its ears being overly sensitive, or sore mouth, tooth problem perhaps. And if those are ruled out, then, and among tooth problems, I'd like to say that remember the wolf teeth. If they haven't been removed, that oftentimes can interfere with the bit. So a good look in their mouth and knowing what's going on in your horse's mouth is a good idea. But if it's none of those issues, and you mentioned clunked in the mouth, I've found that horses that are hard to bridle are usually created by people, and that the person putting the bridle on is not very coordinated with moving that bit into the mouth and
guilty.
Their teeth.
Guilty. Guilty.
So it's a practice.
This horse
thing.
Husband is guilty. Now, I can claim that I have a smaller pony, so there's less mouth, and it's half our fault. Because if he had a bigger mouth, I wouldn't have that problem. But you know, it's just me.
Well, so. And having the right size bit for that smaller mouth is important.
Yes.
So
and try and find a bit for a 12.5 hand pony that is the right one that you need. You know, they make bits for minis and they make bits for horses, and that in between size, the 4-inch, the 4.25-inch, they're tough to find. So
mm-hmm.
yeah. So I he's getting better and I'm getting better and we're all getting better together.
Yeah. And what Christy's talking about with height, and luckily, Glenn, your horse doesn't raise his head too high for you to reach, but
no.
I like all horses to drop their head when I ask to either halter or bridle the horse. And I like my horse to get comfortable with being touched all over its head. Well, actually, all over. The horse should allow you to touch it wherever you and need to touch it. So sometimes to help a horse that's difficult to bridle, working with your hands on its head before you challenge it with, you know, here's the bridle, again, is an exercise that you can do every day. And just make sure that they're not head shy before you start bridling. And
you know, Jill, I wanted to tell you, we had on the opposite end of the scale, I've always owned ponies or Percherons. And we had an over 18-hand Percheron that, that let me tell you, if he had put his head up, you weren't getting the bridle on.
You'd need a stool.
Yep, you would need a stepladder. You weren't going to do it any other way.
Yeah, well, that's where teaching them to lower their head is such a valuable asset.
Jennifer's a little shorter than I am, and I know Jennifer had trouble at times getting that horse's bridle on if he put his head up at all, because it was just too tall.
Yeah. Well, if you can reach their pull with your hand, that would be ideal, because you can relieve the you'll sense when he starts to lower his head and reward him by releasing the pressure. But with your hand, a little pressure, if he's really too tall to reach that way, the halter and a lead rope, just a naggy pressure until he releases and comes down a little bit, and then you release the pressure to train that horse to lower its head when he's requested to lower his head. So that's where you start. And from there, you should also be real familiar with where you can put your fingers in your horse's mouth. And there's the space in between the incisors and the front teeth, and a blank space before you get to the molars. And to have, if you have a horse that grits its teeth when you try and put the bridle in its mouth, you can use your thumb while you're holding the bit to open the mouth and then guide the bit into the mouth. So if you've got the horse lowering its head and you can get it to open its mouth in that fashion, you should be able to put the bridle in the horse's mouth. Now, to get it over the ears, this is where the coordination really comes into play. You might want to, instead of trying to just take the crown piece straight up from where you have gotten the bit into the mouth and be able to put his ears underneath that, you might want to hold on to the cheek pieces over his nose so that the bit stays in his mouth, and then use your hand, your other hand, to put the crown piece over one ear, and at that point you can let loose of the cheek pieces and get the other ear behind the top of the bridle. Then there's a couple of other things that you want to make sure are in the correct place when you're trying to get that bridle on the horse. First, that the curb strap isn't caught on the bottom lip. Make sure that when you've got your hand holding the bit so that you're ready to put it in his mouth, that the curb strap is back far enough that it's not going to catch and keep him from accepting the bit. Once you've got that bit in your horse's mouth, the really big deal is do not hit the horse's teeth with the bit, either while you're putting it on or when you're taking the bridle off. So you need to take your time, be calm about it, and end on a good note.
Absolutely, because I'll tell you, negative reinforcement, oh boy, do they quickly go, oh no, thank you, that rattled my teeth, that rattled my brain, I didn't like that at all. And you know what I highly recommend too, Jill, and I'm just so glad all the points that you brought up, but before, especially for a hard-to-bridle horse, please untie your lead rope before you put that halter around the neck, so that that horse, if it does panic and try to pull back, is not attached around his neck to your whatever you're attached to. Same thing with cross ties. Undo that one cross tie, put the halter around his neck, and then go ahead and bridle.
Absolutely, I have that in my notes here. Don't have your horse tied while you're bridling. So but a couple of things that I don't use, but people report having success with about difficult to bridle horses, is putting something sweet or tasty on the bit, and examples might include molasses, or one lady described having bread with jelly on it wrapped around the bit. So, that's an idea. I don't like to use food treats to have my horses perform basic tasks, but a lot of people go that route, and some folks have found success with treating their horse after the bit, after they've been bridled, and allowing them to have some kind of food treat afterwards. But here's a practical one that a lot of people, you know, Christy mentioned being tall. I'm also tall. By the time my boots are on, I'm about 6 feet, and most horses can't outreach me when they stick their heads up. But opening the cheek piece on the head stall, especially if they have sensitive ears, might be a system that allows a smaller person to get that up over their ears and then fastening the cheek piece back on the side when you've got the bit in their mouth. So
very good point.
But what I have the best success is with is teaching them to lower their head and then being very careful not to bump their teeth.
Yes. Well, Jill, I just so appreciate all of your thoughts today and your suggestions for people out there because, you know, we've all come across some of these ground handling issues, and it might be with our older seasoned horse that we've had forever who just on a particular day is not in the mood. So it's not necessarily just younger, greener horses. You know, these things can happen at any time. How do people find you, Jill? What is your website so that folks can hunt you down?
It would be www.dramenterprises, which is spelled J-R-A-M, and then the word enterprises with no punctuation, .com, dramenterprises.com.
Great. Well, thank you, Jill, so much for being on the show today. It was a pleasure having you.
It was my pleasure to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Jill.
Take care.
Well, you know, again, I love this show because it's things that people, this is a very practical episode that we do every month because it's things that we all deal with at one point or another, especially if you've owned a lot of horses over the years. You've dealt with this with every one of these problems with one horse or another.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, usually multiple horses.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Or is it just us, Christy?
Oh, no, it's definitely not just you. Trust me. Happens all the time. Oh, boy. You know, even change of weather. You know, we were talking earlier in the show about Colorado having these crazy barometric pressure changes. We started off this morning at 40 degrees, and we're now at 80. So that
wow.
change of barometric pressure and the change that happens not only causes colic, which is lovely, but it also can cause behavior changes in your old schoolies. Your good horses that are always great are like, wait a second, there's kind of electricity in the air. It's about to storm, right? And they just are going to act a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And so there's these things come into play all the time.
Well, and we were talking at the end of that about how horses can be difficult to bridle sometimes and the risks of leaving your horse tied to his halter when you've just got it around his neck, because that's a double-edged sword, because if you don't tie him and he decides to leave town, he takes your tack with him. I've experienced that one and gotten a lot of trouble from the boss. But the opposite side of the coin is he can, like, damage himself with that thing around his neck. So we figured that one out for Glenn. Tell Christy about the clever halter you have, Glenn.
I got a custom-made halter for my wife for Christmas. And it's
fancy.
Yeah, it's it has the buckle on the nose piece.
On the top.
So
you can put the bridle right over top of it.
Put the bridle over top of it, and then I take that off, and then it goes around his neck if I want it to. But I can actually leave the halter on while I'm putting the bridle on him. And then once I get the bridle on, I can take the halter off by just unhooking the nose piece. So that
nice.
And they make those. Those are available, not at every tack shop. Jennifer had this one custom made in his colors, blue and yellow. So, you can get those at most tack shops.
And they're really common in Europe. You see them everywhere in Europe. But here in America, we don't use them so much, but they're so useful for working with horses who are a moving target when you put a bridle on. You know, you've got your 10-year-old student try to put a bridle on and the horse is being evasive. There's no better way to lose enthusiasm for putting tack on your horse than having to chase his nose around. And I always found that design so very, very useful. And usually it's just referred to as a buckle nose halter. And they can be found, you see them a lot in the driving industry.
Well, and that's partly because you bring them along for emergencies. And if something goes wrong in the carriage, you can actually just take this halter and quickly get it over top of the bridle. You can put it over the bridle.
Right.
It can happen quickly. Especially if you're out there, you know, you shouldn't be driving by yourself. But if you are or the other person is injured or can't get to the front of the horse and you're the driver and have to get to the front of the horse, you have something to take with you that you can at least keep things under control rather than using the reins.
You don't want to go.
Well, and a lot of programs will leave halters on underneath bridles on purpose, like a lot of trail ride operations, because they want to be able to have that horse at any time. However, for those that do that, I caution you, your bridle is going to fit different with a halter under it than it is with a halter not under it. So you're going to have to adjust your cheek pieces accordingly.
I love that idea she had about dropping the cheek pieces down a little bit for horses who can be a little fussy about their ears. That's very good thinking.
Yes, and then putting the bit in the mouth and then putting it on like a halter. Right?
Yeah,
coming up and around over the years like a halter instead of, you know, simultaneously. That was a great, great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Christy, what's coming up with the CHA over the next month?
Well, I'm excited, actually. Next week, I leave on, I guess it would be a week from Sunday, and I go to the American Horse Council in D.C. They're having a big leadership symposium here towards the end of June, and I get to go and be a part of that, and I really enjoy doing that. I get to do it about every 3 or 4 years, so that's exciting. We still have a ton of clinics out there for the rest of the year, and regional conferences are coming up for folks that want to attend those. They're open to anybody. You do not have to be an instructor. We are here to educate people about the topics that we talked about today and many others, so we'd invite anyone to come and be a part of our regional conferences and our international conference, of course, in Lexington in October.
Very good. And if you're a CHA listener to the show and not a regular listener, we are here Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on Horses in the Morning. Jamie Jennings out of Phoenix, Arizona, an eventer, is my usual co-host. And then we have these special episodes that we do over the month. It's a lot of fun. So we're with you 5 days a week. Tomorrow morning, we have something very special for you that we're doing all across the Horse Radio Network this month, is a Getting to Know the Hosts segments. And what we have done is we have put together sort of an Inside the Actor Studio list of questions for all the different hosts. And we're doing it across all the shows. And tomorrow morning, Jamie, Jennifer, and I answer these questions, and they're all non-horse. Everything is non-horse related, so we're learning the other side of life of the hosts. And so that'll be tomorrow morning's show here in Horses in the Morning, is Jamie, Jennifer, and I's answers to the questions. That'll be what we're doing for you tomorrow.
Oh, what a great idea to learn the other side of the host. I love that.
I learned stuff about myself when I was answering the questions. No, I did learn, I did learn stuff about the host that I work with. You know, we've known Helena for 12 years on Stable Scoop, and I didn't know half the stuff that she answered. So it was very enlightening, and if you're a regular listener, you'll really enjoy tomorrow's show, so take a listen to that. You can find all of the information about the Certified Horsemanship Association at
chainstructorsplural.com.
And you can listen to all the shows on the Horse Radio Network at horseradionetwork.com or at our app. Go to the iOS or Android app store on your phone or iPad and just search for Horse Radio Network. All of our shows are on there. It's free and it's easy to listen to them. Thank you, everybody. And Christy, we'll talk to you again next month.
Sounds good, Glenn and Jen. Thanks very much.
Be safe. Wear your helmets.
I feel so smart now. I feel really smart.
Good.
Right there.
I'm glad.
That was good. Cool. That'll be just about right.